This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. He was born with the name Andrew John Langley, but rugby league and hard rock fans know him as Steve Mascord. There is no rugby league journalist that I respect more than Steve Mascord. Yet those who think that they know him because they've read what he's written in newspapers and magazines over the last 30 years really don't know him at all. As a baby, he was adopted by the Mascord family, who told him that his parents had been killed in a car accident. That wasn't true. He discovered rugby league and heavy metal music as a boy and held on to them for the rest of his life. Or has he? They are the touchstones of his life. But after getting married last year and enjoying the challenge of attending a football match and a concert every week of that year, he reassessed his life and, in this extraordinary memoir, has looked back and asked himself the question, what the hell have I done with my life? The name of his book is Touchstones, Rugby League, Rock and Roll, The Road and Me. And Steve Mascord is our very special guest. Steve, welcome to the program.
It's awesome that you've had me in here, Rod.
Thank you, Steve. Andrew Voss wrote in his recent book that rugby league filled the void in his life after the death of his father. He's about the only person I know who loves rugby league as much as you do. I know a lot of people are big fans of sport, but you and Vossie really, really take it to the nth degree. Was that a similar thing for you as well, that rugby league gave you something in your life that maybe your family didn't?
You know, I was looking, I guess when I was like 5 or 6, I was looking for something to give me a sense of identity. And the best thing I ever, or was it? That's what I tried to answer in the book. But it could be argued the best or worst thing I ever did was to go to the corner store and buy a packet of footy cards in those wax paper and with the bubble gum, the pink bubble gum. And that was the beginning of it. And I guess what I've tried to do here is deconstruct it and try to find out what intrinsic value this has. Is it just a crutch, you know, a social crutch, or does it have some intrinsic value? That's what I tried to find out in this book.
Those footy cards were great ads for, well, rugby league in this case. I know they had exactly the same style and design in Melbourne when it came to VFL cards. They're way too complicated these days, aren't they, the footy cards? In the old days, you bought the pack, you got the gum, you got 5 cards or whatever, and you collected a set of 115 or 132 or 156, depending on what year it was.
Wow.
Now you... Well, I remember. I collected the same ones. Do you still have those footy cards?
Yeah, I've got the old Scanlon's locker, which it was mailed flat and you had to fold all the bits. And I've got them in all the clubs. So on the open door of the locker, You stick the clubs on the cardboard, and then there's a little shelf for each club, and I've still got that. Well, actually, I've combined all the ones from different years into the clubs, and so they're all sorted by clubs, and they're all from different years. I changed storage rooms recently, and I can't say that I actually went in and I didn't throw everything out. You're looking alarmed.
Because, I mean, the storage plays a large role in the book. Well, a minor role in the book.
Yeah.
That your entire life is in this storage room.
But I should have my launch in the storage room.
What a great idea. with your entire collection of Rugby League Week. Is that right?
Yeah.
Or you're missing a few?
I'm missing a few. But now it is, sadly, it is possible to have the complete collection now because Rugby League Week's no longer with us.
So you grew up on the south coast of New South Wales as an Illawarra Steelers fan. How old were you when the Steelers came into the competition?
Okay, I was 13. They came into the competition in 1982. I, in my storage room, have the corner post from their first trial match against South Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting on the... Actually, this is quite a good story. I was sitting on the sideline nearest that corner post. And I was there with two friends. One was a guy called Ian Barrett. The other one might have been Scott Dunn, and they were faster than me, but I said, my dad gave us a lift here, so I'm getting the corner post. I pulled rank on them. And this coming Sunday, the Steelers are having their reunion during the St. George Illawarra Manly game, and Sean O'Connor, who runs the former players, the Rusty Steelers club, he's actually invited me to the function, and I'm sitting at a table with Ian Barrett. I'm actually... he said you can invite three or four friends. And I thought, rather than just invite journo friends or whatever, I go and find some guys on Facebook I went to school with. So Ian Barrett and David McCarthy. David McCarthy might have been the other guy there that night. The three of us are going to be sitting on a table on Sunday at the Steelers reunion. And it's incredible, really, you know.
You know, if Ian Barrett had got that corner post, it would have been lost to history now. You kept it.
You know what he did? For the rest of the season, he got every corner post for the rest of the season to make up for that disappointment. So I went over to his house and he had like versus Penrith, versus East. He had the whole collection until one day when his mum threw them all out. So there you go. He was scarred by that night.
I don't blame him because it was a big deal to run on the field and get the corner post when they were thick cardboard with the black and white swirl around them.
Yeah, yeah. Now they don't even count if a winger hits them when he's scoring
terrible,
a try.
Appalling.
The decline of the corner post in modern civilization. It's there's a book in it, I think.
Well, Andrew Voss
yeah,
is
fault.
Actually responsible.
He'd be the villain. He'd be the villain.
So the Steelers don't really exist anymore. They exist as St. George Illawarra, but the Illawarra Steelers don't exist. How devastating was it when they went out of the competition?
You know, because by then I was an insider, I was involved in the industry, I was a journalist, I don't remember having an enormous emotional reaction because the logic of the joint venture made sense to me. I'm an expansionist. I think there's too many teams in Sydney. Wollongong's not Sydney, by the way. There's 8.5 teams in Sydney, not 9. My brain overruled my heart at that point. I wasn't that upset. I would like them to wear the strip more often than they do. You know, I'd like them, you know, people say the Steelers got the socks. I'm not against the joint venture. I just haven't lived in Wollongong since it happened, so I don't have this emotional connection to it. But I'm not opposed to it, you know.
They weren't all that successful when you were supporting them. Mm. What's it like?
They weren't all that successful, full stop.
Yeah, well, yeah, they made the semifinals. They should have made a grand final,
yep.
And they missed out on one occasion in 1992. So what's it like to support a team that never won?
It probably helped me become the stoic person I am, you have before you today. I in 1992, I had the opportunity to go to the Olympics with AAP, and I declined. There's no way I was going to miss the Steelers in the finals to go to the Olympics, and I've never, ever regretted that decision. At that point, I would get so nervous watching games that I had to look away. I remember one time when it was better for me as a journalist to not have the Steelers because I found it difficult to be objective because I was still that flag-waving idiot, you know what I mean? So I remember one time when they played Great Britain in 1992 in a jersey that hasn't been worn before or since. It's a collector's item. Anyone got one? I'd like to buy one. I think they scored a try and I accidentally punched John McDonald in the face because I went like that, you know, like I know this is radio, but I threw out both arms and I actually punched John McDonald in the face. So the World Club Challenge this year, Phil Wilkinson is a good friend of mine, the Wigan Observer Rugby League reporter and former Rugby League Week correspondent. Everyone's former at Rugby League Week. His wife loves Wigan so much that she had to leave the stadium during the game. She was so nervous and they're playing Cronulla. And like I was like that when the Steelers were around. I couldn't watch. You know what I mean? Yeah. So
I know exactly what you mean. Sometimes you don't want your team to make the grand final because then you can just enjoy the game.
Yes, yes, yes. Exactly, yeah. Good that's gone in my life now. I have teams that I like. Like, I really like the Toronto Wolfpack because they represent the idea that rugby league doesn't have to stay in its box. You know what I mean?
Those who may not know, they now play in the
third tier
English competition. A team from Toronto.
That's right. And I went to their first game, actually, which is one of the greatest experiences in rugby league ever I've ever had. But you know, when they make Super League, if they're not broke by then, or they're not, you know,
that is the first division.
Yes, of, yes, yeah, that's the first division. Yeah. So if, when they make Super League, I might feel like that. I might get so, wow. And that's a great feeling. I love London Broncos. You know, but I don't feel the same. I don't think I'll ever feel the same. The first cut is the deepest. I don't think that I'll ever feel about a sporting team the way I felt about the Steelers.
So then when you become an impartial observer as a journalist, how do you put that fandom aside?
I never lost sight of what got me there. I always realised if I was in this dressing room or I was at this venue, I was there as a journalist. And my job, if I did anything to demean my job, then I wouldn't be here next week. So I always felt it was my job to hold people to account. It was like, you know, it's like if you're a customs officer and you're working at you're working on the desk, and one day your favorite actor, Hollywood actor, comes to the to your desk. Do you wave him through without looking at his passport and ask for a photo? No, you don't. It doesn't matter how. It doesn't mean you're any less a fan that you look at his passport and, you know, you ask him a few questions. It's your job, you know, and I was exactly the same as a journalist.
And you have asked that ethical question Do you ask for an autograph or get a selfie with a player that you respect?
Never. The only time I have two exceptions. My best friend is a guy called Jim Savage, lives in Boston. He's my pen pal of Open Rugby magazine when he was 14 and I was 12.
He was your best man, too.
He's my best man. We've never lived in the same country. He's massive rugby league fan, massive rugby league fan. And I got a jersey, a Queensland jersey autographed by Mal at Charles de Gaulle Airport at the end of the 1994 Kangaroo Tour for Jim. And the other thing is I had my photo taken with Kiss in full makeup. They were in full makeup, not me. and that was not, I wasn't there as a journalist. In fact, I showed up to the gig. It was in Tokyo, sold out. I didn't have a ticket. And I blagged my way into such an extent, I got my photo taken with the band.
Unbelievable.
So I thought that was worth posing. I wasn't going to go, no, I'm not having my photo taken with you. Go away. You know, it's pretty cool. So, but aside from that, I don't do it. I don't ask for autographs. I don't ask people for selfies. You are there to hold them to account. It doesn't matter what you think of their work.
Mm.
That's a separate thing. That's off duty. On duty, you're there, you know.
I won't ask you to sign your book, which is called Touchstones, which is about rugby league, rock and roll.
I will sign your book. Sign your book. There's a power thing in that rule, though, isn't there? That means that I'm deferring to them and I'm insecure about my status alongside theirs. If you're not making the decision to not get the book autographed because you think it demeans you alongside me. You know what I mean? So there's a power thing there. You know what I mean? And if you encounter someone that you think subconsciously you're on the same level as, then you will do that. I mean, I post the photos with people after interviews all the time. But if it's someone who always gets asked for autographs and photos, I just instinctively won't do it. And it's a weird thing.
It's not a weird thing because I don't know that there's anybody in rugby league that perhaps, certainly rugby league journalism, that is as respected as you for your high standards.
Well, that's nice of you to say. I don't know what to say in response.
Asking you to say anything. I'm just saying that there is a certain respect that you have that I don't think anyone else has. But lest people think it's only about rugby league, it's about rock and roll. You mentioned Kiss. And rugby league and, say, even heavy metal or hard rock, which is what you love, are things very much loved by teenage boys. And many people grow out of them. You didn't. Why not?
Because they kept performing the same function in my life that they did when I was a teenager. Maybe because my life didn't progress much after teenage years. I mean, I used to have a saying that if I lay down on the ground and look straight ahead, I can see 1987. There weren't any hills there for me. There was no mortgage. There was no family. There was no soul crushing job. Everything I ever did for work, I would have done for free. I picked 1987 because that's when Appetite for Destruction came out, and my life hadn't changed, and that was the case for 25 years, and I do have a line in the book that I realized when I went to see Guns N' Roses in Nashville last year that I could no longer see 1987, that my life had finally moved on to such an extent there were obstacles between me and 1987, and I hadn't realized they were there until that night.
What is the attraction of incredibly loud music really close up?
When I first bought Hysteria by Def Leppard, I actually went into my bedroom and put one speaker on either side of my head and put the needle down and the first song came on. I think it's Women, I think. And what is the attraction? It's difficult. It's certainly, to me, it's the sound of freedom. You know, it's the sound of there being no constraints. It's the sound of life. You listen to this like Night Train, you know, like it's about drinking 99-cent bottles of wine and not caring, you know what I mean? And so it's an escape from the constructs of society. To me, it's a sense of freedom. But the funny thing is, you know, I'd be someone who tells people that's my sort of music, and One Direction is rubbish, and you know who can listen to any of that rubbish. And you know, today I was walking in the tunnel from Central, and there was a guy on a fiddle, you know, playing, and I got goosebumps. It was like I was in a movie. I could see myself in sort of an arty French movie. You know what I mean? I guess what that says to me is that because I could get a narrative, my mind built a narrative around the music, around the melody, and then I got the goosebumps. And so the narrative that I built around heavy metal and hard rock when I was a kid was a seductive one. You know, when I heard the music, I imagined I was in a convertible on Sunset Strip. You know what I mean? And when I hear Panama, you know, from by Van Halen, that's the vision that's always in my head, and that's why it's one of my favorite songs. You know.
But did you like that music to the exclusion of all others? How did you even get into it?
Everyone liked Kiss when I was a kid. Like in 1980, Kelly Grenfell, who was our class Kiss maniac, she's actually coming on Sunday night to the Steelers Club, so I'm looking forward to seeing her. But and so everyone liked Kiss, so that was my gateway drug. But I liked Cyndi Lauper, I liked Madonna. You know, it wasn't cool to say you liked that sort of stuff. So I recently saw Midnight Oil in Boston, and they were you know, stratospherically good. So no, it wasn't okay. to the exclusion of all others. There was a couple of little things I didn't get, like stuff like Soft Cell and Bronski Beat and stuff like that. I didn't understand that stuff, but. But I liked most of the top 40. But this is the thing I want to say is that my bands were like my team. So I would listen to Casey Kasem's top 40 countdown,
yep.
And I go, Kiss are up 10 spots, and it was like I was cheering the Steelers. They'd won a game. You know what I mean? And so it's your tribe, you know, and you cheer for your tribe, you know.
With sport though, it's similar in that you love rugby league, and sure you've covered other sports, and you've been to your first overseas trip was to a hockey tournament in Pakistan, which is fascinating.
Colonel Gaddafi Stadium.
But so few people love only one sport. If you like one sport, you can see the attraction in others, and you can see, you know, why Roger Federer is such a great tennis player. Or if you like rugby league, you might like rugby union. That's not the case with you.
It isn't, because and that is, again, it probably points to what I liked about rugby league to start with was not the sport itself. It was the iconography, the colours, you know, the footy cards. Yeah, and I liked... I also liked the idea, it helped me make sense of life, that here was this thing that the guys dressed the same every week, and it was on between 3 and 4:45, and then it would be replayed on Seven's Big League at 6 in the evening, and it was in a box. The world was confusing. The more stuff you could put in boxes, and the more brightly coloured the boxes, the easier it was to get through life. And so it helped me make sense of life. So that's why I don't need other sports to do that. Rugby league's done that function for me. And now I'm okay with the, I hope, it's not for me to judge. Now I'm okay with the big bad world out there. So I just don't need, though, I don't need other stuff. You know, I don't need it. So that's probably why I'm not, I've said this before and it alarms people, but I'm not a sports fan. You know, I'm a rugby league fan. I'm not a sports fan. I've got other things in my life that that take the place of cricket and baseball and, you know, whatever. I don't need those, you know.
Steve Mascord is our guest, author of Touchstones. The book is a memoir, but it's also a journey through the year of 2016 as you go through 52 footy games and 52 gigs.
It's actually early. The last entry is May 2017, yeah. So it goes
beyond those the parameter of that year, of course, because it goes back to your early years.
Can I tell you a secret?
Please do.
Jeff Armstrong said, "Don't do all of 2016 because then
he's the publisher.
That'll date it and it'll be bad for Father's Day." So he said, "Start at the World Club Challenge 2016 and finish at the World Club Challenge 2017."
Fair enough.
So that's what I did.
Okay. Yeah. You got married in that year as well. Was that planned, that you think, well, hang on, that's going to be an important part of the book? You don't really hear too much about the wedding. You hear a little bit about it and your mate comes over and he's your best man. But in anyone else's memoir, that would be a centre point of that year. That's not the case.
Yeah, but I just find that, like, weddings and kids are things that my timeline on Facebook is so full of that stuff that I kind of think I kind of put myself in the a place of the reader. You know, a wedding is really important to you. Having kids is really important to you. But to tie it into the narrative, I just didn't think it would work. Okay. I didn't think it would work. And do you really want to read about, you know, how lovely, you know,
I wanted to read how you met your wife, because for someone who is not single-minded, but dual-minded about hard rock and heavy metal and rugby league.
No-minded.
That how do you meet somebody who either likes those things or puts up with those things, because on either side of your wedding, you are flying around the world going to football games.
I had a book to do.
And rock concert. What did you do the week after you got married?
Well, I had to come back here anyway. I had a job yeah. back here. So we had a honeymoon, basically. We had a little honeymoon on the Wild Atlantic Way in Ireland. And then I had to come back here for work. But I did have that Nashville trip was stopover was on the way back. I went to see Guns N' Roses on the way back. It's not like I went away on my own, watched Guns N' Roses, right. and then went back. I was on the way back here. I got a job here. So mm-hmm. I met my wife in the Shakespeare Hotel, where I will be on August 9 at the Rugby League Trivia Night, by the way.
Where I will be as well.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. We're not allowed to stack teams this year, I heard. So yeah. I met her at the Shakespeare Hotel, and I was introduced by a fellow called Dan Tebbutt, who then was a technology journalist. I introduced Dan Tebbutt to his wife. He's now the Australian Trade Commissioner to China, all because he met this lady who's Ukrainian, and they went to live in Moscow. He got a part-time job at the embassy, worked his way up. He's now Australian Trade Commissioner, all because of I went out one night in Moscow. So we introduced us to each other's wives, and Sarah and I went out on and off for a while. When things weren't going so well, she went back to Europe to be closer to her family, and then we subsequently sort of met up over there again. And then one Sunday, it was before the footy season was about to start, and I was about to be working the next 40 Sundays straight. We had our last weekend off. We went down to Brighton, and we were having marinara, I remember, marinara. And she said, I've got something to tell you. She said, I was telling this friend of mine, Val de Baron, who lives up at Gloucester in the Hunter Valley, who she used to work with, about Steve's writing a book. And if it's really bad, he can just write another one under his birth name. Oh, what's his birth name? Andrew John Langley. And this Valda went white. And she said, his mother was a ballerina. His grandfather was a surgeon. She knew my whole family. From that moment, our relationship changed dramatically because she'd made the effort to, like, she cared enough, you know. She hung around, waited for me. So our relationship became, even though we'd known each other for many years up to that point, I was living inside my touchstones at that point. That was all that was important to me was, you know, you can imagine, oh, well, this is our last Sunday because I'm going to go to a game every week, even if I don't have to, you know, for the next 40 weeks, I'm going to go. So this is it. This is your last chance. And then she tells me something like that. And my life changed enormously.
Inside your touch lines as well as your touchstones, might say. Steve Mascord is our guest, not Andrew John Langley. The book, Touchstones, has now a very celebrated opening line. I was conceived in an insane asylum and don't know for sure who my natural father is. How long did you work on that line?
It was the first thing I wrote. I had two previous projects. One was called The Three R's, and it was basically like he died with a falafel in his hand. It had like my flatmate sex stories in it and stuff. He's very upset that that got cut. By the way, I saw him last night. He's never going to forgive me. The second one was called The End of Winter, and it was kind of about being disillusioned with rugby league a little bit. It was around the same time as the Ben Barber thing happened, all that sort of stuff. That was always going to be the opening line. It has been. It's been on a Word document in my various computers for 8 years, 10 years, but it was almost ruined before the book came out because I now have a name of my putative father, thanks to community services here in Sydney. I can't say his name publicly because that would be tantamount to approaching him, and approaching him is something.
And he's still alive?
We don't know. Well, I only have a name, and I've got to actually, now I'm back, I've got to send an email, go and see someone, see if they've found anything. But community services in New South Wales are great with this sort of stuff, you know, very good. So my cherished opening line, was almost ruined, you know, in the end, but it would have been worthwhile to ruin my cherished opening line. But the bottom line is that was always going to be the first line of my book. It is still true. I don't know for sure anything. I just have a name. And I don't know whether people think it's good or bad or confronting or what they think of it, but it was always going to be the opening line.
You've worked as a journalist for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. You have seen so many changes. One of the big changes is you used to go to the games and cover them. Now you can cover those games from anywhere in the world. You watch it on your iPad, the grand final, live tweet it, do all that sort of stuff. You might sit in the office of Fairfax, as you write in the book, watching three games on stupid Saturday, as you call it, on a Saturday, and then cover those games. I would have thought going to the game, you see something that you're never, ever going to see on TV.
Yeah, but equally, when you're at the game, you miss things that you do see on TV. There have been plenty of times when I've been at matches, and I'm not arguing you're right, it is better to be at the game, but I have been at matches where, you know, I've written a match report and someone in the office has seen something and completely rewritten my lead of something I completely missed, you know, something that's said, that's heard over the referee's microphone, something that only a close-up camera can detect. Look, doing the blog on Saturdays, at Fairfax, and it suits my life at the moment. I'm grateful that I've got the opportunity to do it. The great thing in the process of this book was I don't have an NRL media pass this year. When I go to a game, I need to borrow one off someone. And I've been accredited by the Sydney Premiership since 1986, and that does not bother me one iota. I've let go of it. I've let go of it, and that's part of the process was writing this book. So, sure, it's certainly more fun to go to the game. It's my favourite social thing is to go to a rugby league game and hang out with my colleagues. It's one of those jobs, a rare job, where you actually spend more time with your competitors than your fellow employees. You know, you actually hang out with your competitors constantly. So, yes, it's better, but this suits me now, and I'm not obsessed anymore. I don't care, like, Aside from this Steelers reunion thing on Sunday, I'm back here in Sydney. That might be the only NRL game I go to, and I'm completely comfortable with that.
You write at the start of the book, "What the hell have I done with my life?" Are you any closer to answering that question?
Yes, I hope so. That's the whole thing with the book is an attempt to answer it, and I think the book. I don't know. It's for you to judge and the readers to judge whether I successfully answer the question, but I think the things that drove me when I was younger, that made me eccentric, people maybe mocked me about, they served me well, and then I reached a point which I think a lot of people reach when they stopped serving me, they started hurting me, they stopped me forming relationships, which I've outlined earlier, and that I was spending money on the things that make money, which is a zero-sum game, whatever. I actually don't know what that expression means.
Well, somebody wins, somebody loses.
Yeah.
You can't have a winner without a loser.
Yeah. So maybe I did use it in the right context. But anyway, I reached the point where the things that have benefited me, that got me to the point where I'm sitting here talking to you, were hurting me. They were stopping me from having a fully rounded life. The expression I used, I threw all my toys out of the cot, and then I decided which ones to pick up and which to leave laying on the floor. And that's what the book is about. And I'd like to think if you're not interested in rugby league and you don't know who Vinnie Vincent is, and you don't care about me, who wants to read a biography of a guy who runs up and down the sideline at the football? You still will get something, because it's not a biography about a guy who runs up and down the sideline at the football. It's about that. It's about that search, about sifting through things in your life and sorting out which you need to continue and which you must leave behind.
There's so much more. We have just touched the tip of the iceberg. You know, if you like hard rock and heavy metal, you'll love the book. If you like sport or rugby league, especially the rugby league beyond the NRL, which you're such a proponent of, that there's so much more to football than just the NRL or State of Origin, that the game, the way it's played in England, or some of the international games you've seen in parts beyond what we considered to be the rugby league world. But it is a search for finding someone, and obviously you found him at the end. Steve, thank you so much. It is a fascinating, fascinating book.
Really enjoyed the chat. Thanks for having me in.
And that is Steve Mascord, and the name of the book is Touchstones: Rugby League, Rock and Roll, The Road, and Me.